We have the ability to become characters, play characters through fashion, and I really enjoy that and the escape of it as well as the realism of it, because even in the escape there's a reality that you are escaping from and there's a reality that you're also creating. So I love that idea, but also it's beautiful, and I think sometimes beauty's not even sometimes, beauty is always needed in the world, so it creates that space.
That was Trevor Stearman, the South African photographer, whom I recently spoke to about the role of African photography, and specifically African fashion photography, in documenting and shaping the African experience. Something that's become very important to me ever since I got into historical costuming during the 2020 lockdown, where, like everyone else, I decided to cope with the desperation and alienation by hyperfixating on an incredibly niche hobby, like a middle-aged man who just got really into birdwatching. And what's funny about that is that as much as I've always been obsessed with fantasy and fairy tales and princesses and Disney, my interest was sparked by a rather frustrating search for historical African fashion, particularly modes of dress that related to my specific heritage as a Tsonga and Bedi person. I didn't really grow up super connected to this culture. I lived in this mostly urban setting, attended an English-speaking school, and for a very long time was a practicing and devout Christian. But clothing seemed like this really incredible and accessible opportunity to get in touch with this identity. Getting dressed is a language without words, and what it can communicate extends beyond just our ideas of beauty and adornment. But they can reveal the world around us, from our natural environments to our roles in society to our economic systems and what we value and treasure, all through the manipulation of cloth. And my search was frustrating because it was so difficult to find these specific to me sources, in part because I was limited to the confines of a computer screen. Anything that could be found in an oral tradition or a specific monument or keepers of this knowledge in a place removed from me was just out of my orbit. But something I did find was the Black Photo Album by Santi Mufuke, which contained images of Southern Africans from the late Victorian period into the 20th century. You would see Black people decked in Victorian and Edwardian era clothing, from shirtwaists and cravats to big hats and voluminous skirts, wearing the same petticoats and corsetry I'd only to that point ever seen on Europeans of the time. And when I excitedly showed these images to other people, like, look what I found, this is so amazing, have you ever seen this before? They'd always remark about how depressing it all was, that it was this reminder of a time when we were so colonized and oppressed, and that these were souvenirs of our suffering and pain, which, I mean, I don't deny that the rights and freedoms of Black people in these periods were not great, but also there was a fundamental beauty that I felt people were missing out on. It's foreign to us now because photography is such a daily part of our lives, but any portrait you find from the 1800s to perhaps the late 1900s, when cameras became portable and affordable, all of that was really incredibly posed and thought out. So these images aren't just proof of the standards enforced upon these people, but it also showcases the dignity and pride with which they met those ideals. In my discussion with Trevor, we spoke about the work of prolific African photographers like Malik Sidibe, Seydou Keita, and Jean Tapara, who were very monumental in crafting an African vernacular photography, those are Trevor's words and I really like them, particularly at the height of the liberation and independence movements across the continent towards the 20th century. In a lot of their images, you see this very purposeful blend of modernity and tradition. It's typically European silhouettes rendered in indigenous fabrics or adopting older cultural fashions against the backdrop of motorcycles and skyscrapers. And it's creating a new aesthetic through deconstructing both to craft something completely new. We obviously got our independence a lot later here in South Africa, but even in the 40s through to the 80s, there was something similar at this KZN-based photography studio, ZJS Ndebande, where you also saw this dialogue between past and present, and there was something so rebellious and powerful about these images of young Black people and animal skins and beads, and then also shift dresses and penny loafers at the height of apartheid, really taking this care and pride in the way they presented. All of this is to say that I think clothing plays a larger role in shaping and documenting our experiences, showing a proof of life and the assertion of our value and worth. And that perhaps we do ourselves a disservice when we think of these dark periods as only our pain and loss, and not also our very common search, desire, and creation of beauty. Speaking of apartheid, because that's a very smooth segue, it's a concept much more in my mind now in the wake of the South African elections and the real-time genocide in Palestine and the crises that we're seeing in Sudan and Congo. And it seems to me that we need beauty more than ever. And that beauty isn't just the way in which we rebel and combat our suffering, but that it can also be a powerful tool in coping with that same suffering. That even if we aren't ready, it can't always be night. My name is Kinsani, and this is Clothes Minded, a podcast about healing.
So I'm originally half Palestinian, half Panamanian, but grew up as an American. So I was born and raised in the U.S. and then also spent some years in the Gulf countries, so Saudi Arabia and Kuwait to be more specific. It's always been an identity crisis.
I know I promised this was an African fashion history show, but the reason why that is because I've also been faced with the same identity crisis. And like me, Lina's found textile art as this bridge to the distant and seemingly unknowable.
My name is Lina Barkawi. I am a Tafriz practitioner based in the U.S., currently in New York City. I run a business called Lina's Thob. Tafriz is actually an Arabic word that translates to embroidery more broadly. It actually doesn't translate to Palestinian embroidery. And I want to make that distinction because, well, first of all, it encompasses more than just the cross stitch. Palestinians have been practicing embroidery for centuries. I mean, we have them we have the proof in paintings from like centuries ago. And so we know that this is a practice that has been passed down from mother to daughter for a very long time. And what we've learned over time is that the reason that it's so recognizable is because you see these very distinct designs or motifs that are seen on the dress of a Palestinian woman. And they have been traced to their very specific villages that they were from. So women in different villages, you know, you have to remember that before, you know, a century ago, two centuries ago, there wasn't like that much travel happening between the different villages, even though Palestine is quite small in comparison to the rest of the world.
Unless you're very involved in the niche community of cultural embroidery, I don't think Tafriz is widely known, perhaps maybe more now in light of current events. So Lina ended up getting into it after taking a class a couple of years ago in Washington, D.C. with her mother.
My mother, who's Panamanian, actually comes from a long line of seamstresses. And so she grew up very much in the know of textiles and different types of stitching techniques and things like that. And so when I was growing up, she taught me the cross stitch. That was one of her primary, you know, favorite hobbies that she had growing up as well. And so I learned cross stitch quite young. But at the time, it was very much Western types of cross-stitch projects. So things like pictures of animals. I remember there was this one project that I did for my cousin for her first birthday. It was a little duck in had a little suit on and he was walking around. And that was what I ended up framing and giving to my cousin, you know, when I was in middle school. And so I grew up kind of around that, but I didn't really think too much about it. It was more a hobby, not necessarily something that was tied to identity at all.
Until this class, of course, and she started to realize how much Tafriz had always been around her. And like most of us, during the lockdown period, she got incredibly into it.
We had these two pillows that were on the couch and they were both cross-stitched before they were sewn together into pillows. And so I picked one and I was like, I'm going to do this pillow. I'm going to use this as my inspiration and I'm going to just create it. And I ended up spending the whole rest of my time at home that summer working on this pillow, which I then turned into, I just ended up framing it at the time. And that was just the beginning of my Tafriz journey. This was maybe like 6 years ago now, I would say, or 5 years ago. And, you know, over the next couple of years, I started advancing and learning more about Tafriz. I also ended up doing a second master's where I focused on Tafriz. So my entire thesis was about practicing Tafriz in the diaspora and more specifically in the United States. And so I used that master's as a way for me to get smart on Tafriz, its history, its evolution over time. And I just became so in love with this art form and ended up deciding to do the ultimate Tafriz project, which for those who don't know is a Palestinian dress, which is known for the embroidery on the dress. And so I ended up pursuing that project. It took me a couple of years and I picked up a sewing machine on the way. This is when I got into sewing and I just figured it out and ended up making this dress and wearing it and being so ever proud of this dress. And then that was kind of the birth of Lina's Thob. So to document my experience doing this dress, I created my Instagram account, which is called Lina's Thob. I had no intention of making it a business, but after I finished the dress, I just felt like there was such a need by my community to tap into this tool of embroidery as a way to connect to our heritage, our land, our Palestinian identity. And so it's evolved since then. And now I'm doing it full time. I quit my day job. I'm doing it full time now. And I offer a couple of different digital courses in addition to in-person workshops every now and then. My whole mission is essentially to help Palestinians in the diaspora reclaim this ancestral tradition of embroidery. And that's kind of what I'm here to do. But before 1948, the practice of tafriz was very much meant to be for a woman by the woman. So the woman who is wearing the tafriz typically did it herself. And so it would very much express her own individual identity, not just being Palestinian. That wasn't something that women had to worry about, you know, before 1948. There was no question about where they were from. They were just from this village. And so the tafriz reflected that. It would show different colors of what they preferred. It would show their marital status. So you have a lot of dresses that we've now seen, especially from different Bedouin communities, where they would change the color of the thread that they used in their embroidery to blue when they were widowed. And so you could quite literally tell if this woman was married or not based on her, on the colors that she used on her dress. But then you also had, you know, different variations of motifs. The different placements of the motifs on the dress would just, oftentimes it's mostly just a matter of personal preference and artistic style. And so you could really, you know, just, it tells stories about who the woman is who's wearing the dress because she did it herself. And so women were very localized. They spent most of their time amongst their family and their communities. And so you could really you could identify a woman from her dress because she would share those designs amongst the women in her community and no one else would necessarily have access to them. I think what's interesting is that, or what's really remarkable, I guess, more so of this is that all of these designs, while they are passed down, they also hold very significant meaning. And primarily, they hold basically the proof of being indigenous to that land. And so these women, what they would stitch, you know, in addition to what they share amongst themselves, they would stitch what was around them. So they would, you know, look around them. A lot of them were working the land. They were spending a lot of time with the different types of plants, the different animals. And so they would use those things around them. They would use nature primarily as their inspiration and create motifs that they would then put on their dress as a way to celebrate their location and their identity as a person in this, on this land. I think a lot of Palestinians, especially now in this age of, you know, ongoing genocide and this like absolutely ridiculous like amount of needing to prove ourselves or needing to express our Palestinian identity, a lot of people crave the very obvious in your face Palestinian symbols. So you see a lot of people wanting things in the red, black, white, and green colors for it to represent the flag. And I think that is evident in kind of the types of pieces that people will kind of, you know, cater to or go towards. So there's a film called Farha. It's spelled F-A-R-H-A. It's fantastic. It's a great, great film. I think it's on Netflix. And it's about the 1948 Nakba. So it's about, it's following this girl who is, who finds her in like 1948. It's like literally at the time when the state of Israel is created and they're forcibly displacing and killing Palestinians. And what's really striking about that movie to me as someone who practices tafriz was actually the first 10 minutes, because the first 10 minutes is just before everything happens and you see them kind of in their original indigenous like communities doing whatever they were doing beforehand in complete harmony, peace with the land, like just absolute happiness. And what you notice, or what I notice, maybe more so what I notice, is what the people are wearing, because the dresses that they're wearing are very colorful, very diverse, very like not uniform at all. Everything is super unique, super different. And then I compare that to like what people think a Palestinian dress looks like now today. And it's a very different version. And even in like the research that I did during my master's program, one of the things that was made very clear very quickly was the emergence of a very specific dress style. So there was this dress style. And when I say dress style, it's more so like where the embroidery was placed. Just dress style wasn't necessarily, we can't really tie it to any individual village, but it's become basically the dress style of the Palestinian dress. And it's called the six branch dress. And basically what it means is six branches is that you have these panels of tatris that are vertical, and there's two in the front, two on the side panels, and then two on the back. This type of design is not necessarily tied to a specific village. People think it comes from a village in the Ramallah area, but generally speaking, it's not something that was like uniform in all of Palestine before 1948. But people associate this dress as being the Palestinian dress because that was what became popular over time after 1948. I think what's just like really sad to me is like before 1948, like this movie showed, women used to just create these really unique dresses because they were unique individuals. They didn't have to worry about like proving being Palestinian. And then after 1948, everyone kind of wants the same thing. And it's like, it's kind of boring. Like, yes, it proves Palestinian. Yes, it's in like the national colors. It's like either the red on the black or red on the white. And like, so you just don't see those use of the different colors. Like the Palestinians before 1948, they had their own styles. They were super unique and individual and innovative with how they use their embroidery on their dress. And nowadays, you know, people don't know that necessarily. And they think that they, in order to, you know, do Tatris justice or do Palestine justice, they have to stick to this very specific type of style or design. And that's not even the case. Like originally women used to just express themselves through their embroidery. But I did want to talk about the Intifada dress because I know it was something that we were planning on talking about anyways. So in the 80s, there was like this other shift in terms of how Tatris was used. So like I mentioned, before 1948, it was for the women by the woman. After 1948, it was for income as a form of payment. And then in the 80s, when the first Intifada started happening, Israel had banned the use of colors. They had put people on like, you know, on a curfew, schools were closed. Like there were all these things that were happening by the occupation. And so what Palestinian women did, because they banned the use of the flag and the use of the colors of the Palestinian flag, they decided to just stitch everything as Palestinian as possible on their dress. So they would only use the colors of the flag. They would put like different symbols of things like the Dome of the Rock, the letters of the PLO, different imagery of like, you know, people throwing stones at the occupation, very obvious or like, not obvious, but like the stereotypical symbols of Palestine, like olives and, you know, things like that. They would literally stitch that on their dress. And so they would go around walking in this dress that had the flags of the colors of the flag. And it was their way to defy their occupier, very obviously. And it's crazy because now that I've done a dress, like it takes a long time. That's a huge investment of your time and energy. And they did it because they're like, you know, you're going to ban the flag. Then I'm going to wear this on my back and you have to take this dress off my back in order to not have me use the colors of the flag. It wasn't that easy for the Israelis to just take to do that, you know? So that was like another evolution of the Palestinian dress and of Tatris that I think is also something that I think more people are starting to learn more about it, but it also is just, it's a remarkable testament also to just the nature of the Palestinian woman, their involvement in the fight for liberation. You know, not many people talk about the woman's voice in general. And I think Tatris is like just such an easy way to tell their stories and share their experiences with the world.
Sometimes in the face of oppression and struggle, we sort of have to prioritize the collective and sacrifice the individual.
I can't wait until we as Africans actually wear our cloth really proudly and not just on Heritage Day, because there's so much significance. And I think South Africa can take a cue from Congo and from West Africa or East Africa where it is a norm. But then again, I also think South Africans, we are so diverse and our identity is evolving. So there's opportunity to also create new fabrics that tell a different story. So what does that diverse fabric look like?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing to think about. Like I went to Kenya last year and And I was actually just very shocked to see, like, it was such a different way of life to see how many people. And I remember my friend, she lives in Kenya, when I was like, oh, everyone wears like their traditional dress, their folk dress. And she was like, we don't even call it that. It's just, it's just clothing. And I was like, oh, exactly. You know what I mean? I was like, actually, I've never even thought about that. Like, to me, I'm like, there's my clothing, and then there's my traditional clothing, when it's like, what does that mean? But I was also thinking that maybe it's also part of the problem, like in South African context, because we are this very, very diverse nation, like, even more than like the sort of 12 or 13 now recognized languages, there's so many different ethnic groups within that. But I mean, like, yes, we'll have like the race of it, but there are so many different ethnicities within that. And then obviously, like, people mixed and they get together and new things come from that. And I think perhaps when we were trying to build this rainbow nation, we got so obsessed with like unity that it was like the easiest thing was just to be like, okay, we're all just going to sort of accept the sort of Western mode, as opposed to sort of dealing with like the many different facets of our country and our culture, and like trying to represent that and still a very uniform, singular, like national identity. You know what I mean? Because like, what is a typical South African like outfit garment? So that's me, Animan, who runs Sari for Change, a fashion brand repurposing secondhand saris while teaching women how to sew and eventually start their own businesses. Recently, she started an advocacy project linking Palestine and Africa, much like this podcast.
I'll speak about why we started Textiles for Justice and why there's this link to wanting to start an advocacy that preserves textiles or informs people about textiles. I think if we start with the colonial and post-colonial struggles, like both African nations and Palestine have gone through colonization. Okay, in Palestine's context, they're still fighting for their self-determination. But there are a lot of parallels in our history, their history, resisting against foreign rule, that creates a natural sense of, I would say, affinity and solidarity. And so this is where Textiles for Justice was born. Textiles has been a way to express identity and resistance. In Africa, if we look at the kente cloth, and in Palestine, we look at the tatris, the embroidery. They aren't just beautiful art forms, but they're also powerful political statements. Similarly, the kanga, you know, it's got these proverbs that speak to solidarity and speaks about the political climate in Kenya, or I guess Kenya and Tanzania. And so if we look to our history, there's also this interesting cultural exchange or trade exchange that was happening. And through my experience of Sari for Change, I've seen the similar motifs and patterns. Like, I can see it in a kanga, and I can see it in a sari, and I can see it in a Palestinian cloth. And for me, that's what's piqued the curiosity, is like, what is the similarity here? We are so connected, and we have all these similar motives and symbols. And it's because we've got this heritage of struggle and self-determination and wanting to preserve our culture.
Like, recently I was like looking at like Suzani embroidery, and I was also noticing like these parallels with the embroidery of like my ancestors that they do. And actually, it's quite similar to a lot of other African embroidery styles I've seen. And I thought that was so interesting that, like, you know, these are two very far removed places. I'm not going to always be aware of like what exactly might have been the interaction, if there were any at all. It's also a very beautiful thing to see, like, all these ways we all just search for meaning and beauty, and that, you know, we can be so connected to like our environment and the world around us and the people we're with, that we wear our hearts literally on our sleeve. You know, we actually want to carry that on exactly. Our bodies everywhere we go, in a way you can't do with like a building or a book. You get to very quickly communicate like who you are and who you love and, you know, what you value without any words.
That's essentially the fashion revolution, right? Is that you do get to wear your values on your heart and your sleeve. You can wear sustainability and, you know, in this case, wear a product that represents the struggle in Palestine and Congo. I think it's so important because as the global South, we've had our worth taken away from us.
As I was doing this dress, and so I knew that I wanted to be very intentional with my design. The colors that I chose, honestly, are just colors that I really love. They're different than the traditional colors. They speak to me of fall and autumn, and like falling leaves. And I just love that time of the year, especially here in the Northeast and Northeast in the US. So I chose those colors because I love them personally. They're what I think are beautiful as a combination. And then in terms of designs and motifs, the reason I named my Instagram account Lina's Thobe is because it quite literally is like Lina's Thobe. It's a thobe about Lina. Basically, it's a very narcissistic dress when I think about it. And so all the motifs are something that matter to me. So I have a border that is called Malaulau, which translates to curl. So because my hair is very curly, it's a big, a piece of my like identity. I have a motif signifying the meaning of my name. So I have a little palm tree in there. And then I was talking to my grandmother, my Panamanian grandmother, about the dress because she like that side of the family like loves this kind of stuff. So I was telling her about my ideas and all these things. And she's like, oh, wow. And I was telling her also about like what Tatriz is and what it means and its connection to land. And she's like, oh, that's so interesting. Like, Lina, you should do something that, because it represents the land, like you should make your dress also represent the world. And like what she meant by that was, you know, at the bottom of the dress is like a lot of like fauna and floor and flowers and, you know, like ground land type of motifs. And then as you move up the dress, you hit like the stars and the sky and birds and mountains. And I loved that imagery so much, but it was a little bit too late into my design. So I tried to incorporate a little bit of that because I loved it. So like when you look at my chest piece, for example, I do at the bottom is like a water spring. And then as you move up, you hit some mountains and then you hit palm trees and stars are at the top. And like that was done intentionally to kind of honor her suggestion. And then of course, because my mother is Panamanian and she's the one who taught me cross stitch, I had to embed her into my dress. And so what I decided to go with was an orchid motif, which is not Palestine at all, actually. It was a photo that I found on Google and then I turned it into a cross stitch pattern and I added it into the location that I wanted. So I have Panamanian orchids kind of in certain places of the design. And so that's just to honor my Panamanian heritage and my mother as well. But yeah, those were kind of the things that I used to inspire the design. And it's interesting because I, like when I first kind of released the final product, I got all these comments that were like, oh, this is so beautiful, but it is so different. How, like, where did you find it? Like, how did you do this? And I think it's because, again, like I leaned into that tradition of using your own individuality to express yourself. It's not just going to be another Palestinian thobe, but it's going to be something that's unique to me because there's only one of me, you know, right now in the world that I'm aware of. And that's beautiful. And I think that's something that's like the part that I don't think has been, it hasn't been understood by the Palestinian community in general. And that's part of, that's like my entire mission is like helping people interact with that concept a little bit more and lean into them themselves. And, but yeah, I think that was kind of what I did. And because of that experience, every time I work on Palestine, it's like a way for me to literally feel a connection to Palestine without being there, without needing to know the language, without needing to have like a life experience that was rooted and associated with the specific land of Palestine. It is my way of being Palestinian, essentially. And I think that's also something else that I hope to help, you know, share with the rest of the world as well, as since we are a very like global diaspora, we're all over the place. And we have very, very different experiences as well.
I think that's really great because I think that's also something I've just really enjoyed as well when I've done like my own embroidery projects. It's also like just similar to you. Like I've done this fusion of, so I've taken like what I know of traditional techniques and also like you, like no one actually taught me was kind of a thing I had to sort of do on my own. But, and also you said it's a great way to sort of connect culturally and across time and space. And, you know, you're not always limited by like language or location and things, but you get to go through the same sort of practice someone did, like either across the world or 100 years
exactly.
Or, you know, in that moment you can feel that oneness. And when I do my projects, I always try to incorporate different like things. So there's like the things that I really like a lot. So like, you know, there's always a lot of pink because that's my favorite color. So my grandmother used to have this really lovely garden. And it was always super strange because like where she lived was kind of like a little bit like deserty or very dry, but she always had this huge patch of green and she was really good with that stuff, which didn't get passed down to me, unfortunately. I can't grow anything. But yeah, I always think about that's terrible. But yeah, you know, there's always the flowers and the things I saw in my garden that I'll put there. Things like we have a clan animal, so that's like an elephant. I'll always try to incorporate some element of that. And I just think that's there's just something very beautiful about spending your time. And you're also, I'm imagining when you're like also working on this, you get to just like really think about these connections and all these people in your life. And also the people not directly in your life, but that you're also connected to. And I've always found a very like meditative, like almost prayer like aspect to it. It's so like grounding and rewarding and fulfilling. Yes. Very nice to hear someone else sort of have that exact same feeling as well.
Sure. It's always, so it's different kind of emotions. And I think, again, depending on what theme we're dealing with, sometimes there's a lot of laughter as people recall and share their experiences. And sometimes it's a lot of sadness as well when remembering and revisiting moments of loss. My name is Puleng Sekgalo, and I'm a professor of psychology working for the University of South Africa. I'm currently serving as a research chair, working on various research projects.
In 2005, Puleng Sekgalo began a project which brought together women who grew up in apartheid to document their experiences of the time through embroidery. The final work, so these colourful depictions of street scenes and urban landscapes and even acts of violence, and these brilliant colours, bright reds and oranges and greens, set against a contrasting black cotton backdrop. It's very much in a typically South African style, for lack of a better term.
Because I think of the solidarity and the collective safe space, it allows for that vulnerability. So we would sit together, we often sit with flip charts, and then we write down the ideas and we write down the themes. So looking at a global issue, but bringing it home to the personal experience as well. So there's always that shift between the personal and the collective all the time. So we come together and then we share ideas, and then we note the ideas down. We also sometimes record the conversation to revisit it also as part of reflection after the work is done.
In my own personal quest to connect to my roots, I was fortunate to come across the works done at Garos, which is a Limpopo-based collective of primarily Tsonga embroideries. Garos originally was a word that referred to the animal skin cloaks worn by the San and the Khoi, which would later evolve into wool or cloth blankets like those worn by Sotho people. And this collective began as a group of women sitting on a Garos, or a blanket, doing needlework. The scenes and artwork depicted, which are now sold as cushion covers and wall hangings, often draw from Batsonga mythology and folklore. And you'll find a lot of culturally significant motifs like elephants, fish, anything you can find in the Limpopo River, the sun, moon, and stars, all in this very rhythmic and brightly colored compilation of chain and stem stitches. Now, Garos was founded in 1988 by a white woman, Irma van Rooyen, and while inspired by traditional Tsonga artwork, a lot of the early designs were her own style, it seems like. However, there are original designs done now by the makers presently working there, and if you check out my Instagram, you can also find some more made by Tsonga people designs as well. A lot of these art styles take inspiration from the way women would decorate the exterior walls of their homes, and embroidery collectives such as these have played a role in providing work and demand for these skills. Similarly, there's Tambani, which works with vendor embroiderers, also started by another white woman, funny enough, with the same ideals of skill conservation and women empowerment. And what's particularly great about that project is that you'll also find written versions of the vendor folktales referenced in the artworks, which include, but are not limited to, tales of man-eating elephants and chameleons that can't be trusted. Further south in the Eastern Cape, there's the Keskama Art Project, which, to quote the website, produces major textile artworks to aid in the archiving of the rural Eastern Cape's collective memory and the preservation of oral history. In a way, you can think of embroidery as the natural evolution or the descendant of the cave painting, and offering a permanent and visual language to that oral storytelling tradition.
So I definitely grew up around Palestinian communities, but it's, you know, it's so crazy because Tatriz is not something that is necessarily like in the communities that I have been a part of, it hasn't been something that I've ever seen practiced. I've not, like, it's not something that, you know, my friend's mother will do with tea with her friends or something, and like we stumble upon them practicing tapris, or like I've never had that experience ever. And I think it goes to the change in the use of tapris over time. And so, you know, like I mentioned, before 1948, the practice of embroidery for Palestinian women was done for themselves, right? And then when 1948 happened, and, you know, almost a million people are forcibly displaced and they're forced into refugee camps, the women who knew, who had the knowledge of tatris, then used it as a form of income, because it could no longer be a casual, leisurely hobby anymore for them. They had to make ends meet and provide for their families. And because they were separated from the land that they do know how to use for income typically, they then turned to tatris as that form of income. And so the knowledge remained as, like, for this purpose of making money, which is very, it's a very different approach to something that is done for yourself, where you're thinking about your, like, expressing yourself artistically. And so this is my personal opinion. I can't necessarily prove it, but my personal opinion is that because of that huge shift in what tatris meant for Palestinian people in 1948, it changed how the Palestinian communities then viewed it, then had access to it. And it, like, the loss of that knowledge was started to happen, because they no longer were, you know, and I talk to people now in Palestine who are working with artisans in Palestine to this day. And a lot of the women who hold the knowledge of tatris, they no longer want to pass it down to their kids because it doesn't make that much money. They want their kids to have better economic opportunities. And so why would they teach them tatris when it doesn't offer them a form of income? And so now you're seeing the shift, though, the pendulum swing the other way, because the people in the diaspora, like myself, we have time that we could spend on something that's leisurely and not, we already have jobs. We have access to education and opportunities in the West. And so we now have the flexibility, the privilege to pick up tatris just for ourselves and not as a form of payment. And so now you see, like, there's a new kind of surge of interest in tatris by people like myself in the diaspora. And it's because of these different factors, you know, that are playing in our favor. I'm forgetting your original question now. I'm going on a tangent.
No, I love that. I also forgot what my original question was. I also just found it very interesting, because there's interesting parallels, because I've seen that a lot here, even in South Africa. There are lots of, like, groups of women who perhaps, I think maybe certain kinds of, like, cloth making or embroidery was either, like, purely just, like, for, like, your children and stuff, or for yourself. But as people have done, like, less and less, like, agriculture or farming, and, like, had to get urbanized, etc., a lot of these women go back to those sort of skills and stuff, but purely, like, it is to sell stuff. And do you think with, like, I don't know if this happens with tatris, but I've seen this happen, like, here with some types of beading, or sort of up and down, where, like, a lot of it gets very sort of commercialized, or it sort of has to, the part of why it changes or it looks a certain way is also because it's getting repackaged to, you know, often the people with the most dollars and stuff, which happens to be tourists or, like, Westerners or anything.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it's less so on the tourism front, although I'm not sure. That one, that's an interesting question, because I honestly can't answer it. I don't know, in terms of, like, people who travel to Palestine, if they're catering to, you know, non-Palestinians, and what their preferences are from an embroidery perspective. But from a Palestinian community perspective, I would say that it has definitely changed and shifted over time.
I think it's very important, because when you look at, like, Palestine, it's, like, also, like, I mean, along with, like, the loss of, like, hospitals or, like, really important, like, public systems, we're seeing, like, universities destroyed and books and things like that. And I think that goes a long way to sort of, like, dehumanizing them as well, on top of, like, the really violent atrocities. It's like there's no record of who these people were or how exactly they are. And I think you also get, like, you see that sort of parallel here in Africa as well, where we feel like, or it just seems like, you know, like, it was only once, like, Westerners got here that we got clothes or something.
Exactly. And I mean, when you burn books, right, your history is essentially rewritten for you. And so then you go on this journey of exploration to realize that's actually not the right history. That's not your history. And you actually come from this great line of kings and queens or whatever it is. And I say fabric or linking to your traditional fabric is more of like a journey to self-worth and self-love, because it is, it gets taken away from you, from society, like telling you who you should be and what you should wear and what you should do. And for me personally, this connection to my textiles has been this journey of self-love and why I would always advocate to preserve it, and why I'm so interested in finding more about the different textiles and the motives and symbolism. In a way, it is exactly that. It's preserving that. I don't want future generations to feel lost and not know where they come from. And at the rate that the West is going, I don't know. It's quite scary.
Oh, why did I choose embroidery? Okay, I come from the psychology field, and in psychology we talk. It's all about talking. It's all about trying to understand people's experiences through them expressing in words what it is that they're going through or what they've gone through. But I also felt that with issues like trauma, for example, sometimes words are not enough. Sometimes it's not easy to be able to speak about experiences of trauma, about difficult things that people have gone through in their lives. So I then thought about other ways in which people can experience that which is difficult to express in words. Women who went through or who experienced apartheid could be able to express through this mode of expression that is embroidery. But also because visual methodologies allow for multiple interpretations of experiences. So for the one who's looking at the embroidery, they can also understand in the way that perhaps the next person may not understand it. So it also allows for that broader analysis, if you will, or interpretation of the visual work. That broadens the ways in which we think about psychology, because we often don't do visual narratives or methodologies such as embroidery in psychology. Yes, there's been a move towards now photo voice, for example, or theater work, but as a way that allows for something that or a skill that women would already have. Because as I was saying, that many young people who grew up during apartheid, particularly as part of the education system at that time, needlework was also at the core of that. And so the skill is there, because many of the women's stories of apartheid in South Africa and resistance and solidarity are often not told. And sometimes when you go back even to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, many of the women's narratives were not told. And for a number of reasons, some of the things were very stigmatizing to women's womanhood and could have been perceived by others as embarrassing. So how do you speak about certain things in public platforms that are televised such as that? Yes, there were special women's hearings after, you know, the other hearing, but it's through observing and looking at those things and saying often women don't have the platform and the opportunity to be able to speak about what they're going through. And sometimes it's because it's difficult, or they struggle with the language to be able to express. And that's why it's easier to then just speak about my son that disappeared, or my husband, or my father. But the everyday violence that actually took place, that women went through, that affected them severely, was often not told. And when you sit with women to try and speak about these things, sometimes it's very difficult. So tapping into embroidery actually allowed for some of the things that they would otherwise not have been able to share.
When we're in the South African context, there's always this looming economic presence, right? A big part of why Keskama, Karoso, Tambani exists is also an attempt to solve the burden on South African Black women, many of whom have to be the sole providers for their families while always being the most disadvantaged in our society. In her article discussing the Apartheid Embroidery Project, Professor Sihalo also makes mention that due to the nature of the Bantu education system in apartheid, a lot of the women involved had an education limited to this kind of labor and skill, and not much else. And as a country, we did used to have this very thriving textile industry. A lot of that due to the fact that we had this huge cheap labor force. You know, as Archer says, slavery, what's not to like? It's free labor.
So I'm actually in the business with my mom, who's been in the clothing industry for 35 years. And through her journey of being in the clothing industry, she saw how incredibly exploitative it is to the planet and also to people.
But when that industry went into decline at the end of apartheid following the opening of our borders, very relaxed import regulations and increased dependence on foreign textiles and clothing, there was an entire skilled labor force now unemployed.
Oh, wait, before I forget, I always like to hear, because you said your mom was working in the textile industry for a long time.
Yes.
Was that here in South Africa?
So she, originally it was in South Africa, and so we actually come from a family that worked in the South African clothing industry. So there was a factory called Rex Reform, which sadly closed down, and it was many years ago during apartheid, and a lot of my family members worked in that factory. And this is where Sorry for Change comes in. We would like to restart the manufacturing industry. That's our long-term vision, is revolutionizing the South African fashion industry, making it more sustainable, and also just getting more people on board. Like, we don't have a skilled labor force. We don't have enough pattern makers. We don't have enough, you know, designers. There's just not enough support for this industry to really thrive.
Using embroidery to discuss the trauma and experiences of Black women during apartheid wasn't Professor Sekgalo's only project. During lockdown, South Africa's extreme rates of femicide and gender-based violence became even more vocal. This is particularly potent when you consider what a gendered field textiles are. Historically, weaving, sewing, and embroidery have always belonged in the woman's sphere, a domestic activity for the people who stay at home while the men go out to hunt and conquer industry. And since fashion and craft is built so much on the backs of female labor, we're taught to devalue it and see it as inferior.
It's also about aesthetics as well, that it should look appealing. And the idea there was that, so even in the midst of pain, even in the midst of loss, even in the midst of hopelessness, in terms of some of the themes that we would be focusing on, that there should also be a sense of hope. It's done in such a beautiful way, which also for us is a way of saying, in the midst of all of this, there's still hope.
More traditional art forms like sculpture and painting are seen as superior to these quote-unquote crafts. But I think that's so funny because when you're making clothing or blankets or any other kind of homeware, one has to achieve both the task of making something that is visually appealing and also functional. Everyone requires clothing to live in this world, but we won't consider the humanity and the value of the people who make that possible. And beyond the more basic function of providing warmth or sun protection or modesty, or helping us feel attractive or signaling our status and role in society, there's also this restorative and healing function that Professor Sekgalo's work has demonstrated.
I believe you participated when you were doing the COVID and GBV project. You also embroidered as well. And can you just sort of just tell us a bit, like, what was that experience for you and what did you learn and how did you find it?
I think for a long time, I've been more of an observer, participating in a different way, like participant observation, if you will. Over time and with the work that we did around gender-based violence, that project, where I then became actively involved in the actual making of the embroideries. It was quite surreal, but it was also a humbling moment because it was an opportunity also to learn, to sit back and to open myself up to learning as well. Because many of the techniques I did not know, and it was quite beautiful to then sit and be shown, right? And to be shown and to actually see your hand and someone's hand also directing you and leading you. So we would do the work at home on our own, and then we come together twice a week and then work collectively, check on each other's work, and then and just learning, like revisiting the skill, but also learning different techniques also of doing. It forces you to also to come into yourself, if you will. Because again, it's that repetitive movement, right? It's a repetitive movement of doing something over and over and over and over again. And for you to be able to do it right, because again, you don't want to now have to undo something. It's very difficult. So you also, the focus that it requires forces you also to then be quiet, if that makes sense, in your mind as you do that work and as that repetition and repetition and repetition. And it really, it is, you know, like I said, it's like a moment of meditation, if you will. But also just thinking about what it is that you're doing. So the work that you're doing. So as I was busy threading and writing stock GBV. So I was actually needling the actual words, stop GBV, and then just reflecting on the challenges that are confronting us as a country when it comes to gender-based violence, when I think about the loss of life and women through femicide. And so over and over, this stop GBV, you know, just going through my head as I go back and forth, needling. So I think really it's a form of meditation in some way, and a moment also of reflection as you do the work. Actually never reflected so deeply about it before. But because I always think outward. So it forces me to go inward.
When I was doing my work on my thesis, I interviewed, I think it was like 12 different Palestinians in the US about their own Tafriz experiences. And so many of them actually use Tafriz as a way to like make prayers for loved ones who have recently passed away. And also as a, like, so you're also connecting to people in your family, even if it's like not, like I haven't done that exercise of thinking about, you know, the Palestinian version of me from like 200 years ago, that would be a really interesting experience. But even if it's just someone who you recently lost, you're able to kind of spend that time thinking about them, talking to them. And that is only possible because of the repetitive motion of embroidery or of sewing, you know, where you're just kind of, you know what you're doing, you don't have to think too hard about it, but it's keeping your hands busy. And it's a direct connection. I think that's such a powerful part of the practice. Yeah.
No, I love those. I used to always have this like joke with my one friend. I don't know if you've ever watched like the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, like, so his uncle dies and then he makes that Spider-Man costume like the next couple of days. And I was like, that is so relatable. Like whenever I'm going to do something, I also get into the next big project. Like,
yes, that's so true. That's so true. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's, I don't so know funny. Where you that beautiful suit. And I was like, that's, when did you? Okay, cool.
Yeah. Now I need to go watch that movie again. That's so
yeah,
funny.
Like, you should be the next thing. He's just at the sewing machine. And I'm like, that is exactly how I would deal with grief. Yeah. Like, 100%. And then also developing another weird dangerous hobby as well.
The making of the embroideries is not only limited to the room where we come together twice a week, the work also gets taken home. And when it gets taken home, you continue making embroideries at home. And that also allows space for opening up conversations with your own children at home as well. And this is what came up a lot with Abu Mama, that, you know, when they're at home, then the child, the daughter or the son would ask, what are you doing or what are you busy with? And then that offers the opportunity to have that conversation around that particular issue. That I find amazing. It was particularly, I think, sure, powerful when we were doing the initial project around growing up during apartheid, because some of the women had indicated that some of the experiences and things that they had gone through, they had never shared with anyone. They had never shared with their families. Their families didn't even know. Some of the things happened before they got married, before they had children. And so that was never part of the conversation. But doing those embroideries and reflecting on their lives back then, revisiting those memories, allowed for them to now also have conversations with their children about things that they otherwise would not just wake up and talk to them about.
With your first project, you were working with women who grew up in apartheid. So by the time you're working with them, they're much older. But that's where they had sort of learned these skills. With the recent ones, have you worked with much younger groups of women or had any younger women involved in the project?
Yes, the majority is still much older women, but there are a few who are younger. That's been very interesting also because of the view and life. I mean, some of the conversations we're having, particularly with the Gender-Based Violence Project, around, you know, some of the challenges facing women, some of the challenges facing families, how women are treated in the streets, and how, again, it's young women who would be walking in the streets and then, you know, catcalled and experience these challenges in the streets. So it also allowed for different perspectives and experiences based on lived realities as well. Because as you can imagine, a 58 or 65-year-old woman, the chances of her being walking in the street and then being, you know, whistled at by boys or men are very small vis-a-vis a younger woman. And what that means, you know, you're walking and someone just pulls your hand and what that means. So it also allows for a myriad of and varying experiences to come to the fore so that we have this hopeful, holistic view in terms of the different ways in which gender-based violence manifests and shows itself in our lives.
My name is Kensani, and this has been Closed Minded, a podcast about how beauty is always needed in the world. I know it's easy to feel like we're in the end times, and it's not breaking news to anyone that things kind of suck right now. But I do hope we can look to these acts and inspiring people to remind us of the hope and light that's still available to us. If you'd like to support any Palestinian, Congolese, Sudanese, or South African causes, I'll be linking that below in the show notes. In particular, if you're in South Africa, Gift of the Givers is an amazing organization that does impactful work across the world, and they could always do with more funding. But I must also stress that you can also show solidarity through amplifying messages online and making these issues a topic of conversation wherever you can. It's not all going to be fixed by money, and there are small ways you can participate, including boycotting certain brands and amplifying Palestinian, Congolese, and Sudanese voices. Thank you to my amazing guests in this episode. They'll all be linked in the show notes as well. I highly, highly recommend you check every single one of them out, and particularly if you're interested in having any sort of open dialogue about the links between Palestine, Congo, Sudan, South Africa, through Textiles. Textiles for Justice is a open Instagram page and sort of knowledge sharing platform that you should 100% visit. And also, again, if you've made it to the end, thank you so much for listening and taking this very long journey. I'm pretty sure you must be a super sexy person if you're still here. You can follow me on Instagram at OKBaddieK or subscribe to my newsletter, Hanger Management, where I have more regular updates. We'll include some visual references. And if you're able to and willing, you can support the show monetarily by donating to my Buy Me a Coffee account or becoming a paid subscriber on the newsletter. I'm out. That's it.